You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Counterculture, here with Marie on Reality Check Radio, and joining me now is Anne Battley-Burton. I haven't caught up with you for ages, Anne, and I saw you in the paper recently, two stories on one weekend, and I thought, right, it is time to catch up with our favourite cat lady and woman of champagne. How are you?
Well, it's absolutely fantastic. I'm feeling $1 million after 9 weeks in France, as you can imagine. Longest I've ever spent there since, you know, since I married the cuddly. Before, of course, I had those Frenchmen, but that was a different thing. So now it was a real treat to be able to get back there and actually have some time and really get around and see what's going on in France. Yep. And I was pleased to say that I found it so uplifting being there because, you know, you hear a lot of things about it, all doom and gloom and riots and problems and all sorts of issues over there. And I'm not saying that there wasn't any issues, particularly with the elections going on and things like that. But where we were the vast majority of the time, which is where we got the house, you know, in the south of France, it was so well organized. Everything, you felt so safe everywhere on the streets. They got rid of all these sort of boy races in there, racy motorbikes roaring up and down the street and selling drugs and God knows what, all the things that were going on and little gangs and so on, that you started to feel nervous, even in the little villages. And we felt so safe and the place was amazing. And it was so prosperous, which was fantastic because all around the villages where we are, sort of in sort of it's within 100 Ks inland from Nice, a lot of activity, a lot of investment. The wine industry down in there, I know it's different in certain other areas like in Bordeaux where sadly they're ripping out vines and so on. But where we are, the grape varieties are quite different. A lot of rosé, a lot of the roll, or otherwise known as the Vermentino. And that was just flourishing. And the other good thing is that they've actually basically making the sprays illegal. So the vast majority of the wineries are biologique. So there was proliferation of beautiful little bumblebees and butterflies just everywhere around our property, and we're surrounded by vineyards but we're up on the hill. So that was just so nice to see, and it really gave us a boost to come back. Mind you, when we got back it wasn't quite so exciting, of course, but still it was just so refreshing to see it can be done. We can move forward and get out of that mess that we're in with COVID and so on. If they can do it over there, we can do it here, right?
Absolutely. Now, because, of course, the French have been making wine for hundreds and hundreds of years. It must be really good to see the fact that they can pivot like that. Has the resurgence of rosé, which, of course, is international, has that really given them a lift? Because, I mean, that is a variety very synonymous with that part of the world.
Well, it is. And I remember years ago when I first started importing wine, which is, gosh, it's got to be about 25 years ago now, rosé was unheard of in New Zealand, if you remember. And I started bringing in some rosé, which, funnily enough, Jean-Christophe from Maison Marron, he's bringing in the brand now, funnily enough. But at the time, I found it so difficult to sell rosé. People were not interested at all. There were a few people who travelled to France and would enjoy it over there and think, oh, gosh, it's so lovely, but, hey, it's different here because, you know, it's not the same atmosphere, it's not the same weather, it's, you know, you just don't want to drink it. Well, that has totally changed. And from being surrounded by vines that were basically unkempt, not even being utilised at all, it was just a mess before when I first bought that property. And now they are flourishing and the region has become really very, very successful. And, the vast majority of it is the rosé, but I think generally speaking, all the vineyards are now being much better cared for.
In the paper, Ricardo Simic did a great piece, and it's from the Weekend Herald, August 24, Brut Reality, Sparkle Fades from Sales of Champagne. Now, luxury goods company LVMH, which is Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy, their managing director Jean-Jacques Guenny, he said champagne is quite linked with celebration, happiness, etc. He cites the drop to the fact that people are struggling to find joy right now. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have to say I beg to differ on that. I think if you want to find joy, for God's sake, grab a glass of champagne. Because champagne, for me, whether I'm like Madame Lily Bollinger used to say, but I know it very particularly for myself, whether you're happy or whether you're sad, you feel even better with a glass of champagne. And I can say that, you know, very personally, because one of the things that I do is that apart from just, I mean, I drink champagne all the time because I love it. And luckily, being an importer, I have the luxury of being able to do that. But the thing is, when I have very sad moments too, first thing I do is go to the champagne. Now, when I'm talking about that, my experiences are more things like when each of my parents died and when I was absolutely devastated. Right, let's get some champagne. Both of their funerals, their memorial services, we had tons of champagne. And it made such a difference to everybody. Instead of everybody going around there terribly down and depressed and just a maudlin horrible thing, it uplifted everybody's spirits. And instead of being so down and depressed, I mean, they both had good lives, you know. The fact was it uplifted them and everyone was laughing, remembering all the memorabilia. It just boosted everybody's spirits. And we ended up having these wonderful occasions. Same thing, you know, me and the posses. And every time one of my cats dies, whether it's one of my very personal cats or whether it's been one that I've rescued in the sanctuary and become attached to and so on, it always really hurts me. And sometimes we've had, you know, we've often had situations where you've got to go and put the cat to sleep and got to go through this whole ordeal. And the moment it's done, I say, right, let's get some champagne. We'll crack open a bottle. And whoever's been with me at the time, whether it's the vet or whoever, you know, assuming it's at home, of course, you know, I've got a glass and said, hey, here's the wee boy or here's the yuki dooky doll or whoever it happens to be. And we'll have tears and, you know, have a glass of champagne and we actually feel better. So it's, I think it's very important in any occasion because it just uplifts your spirits, makes you feel better. So I don't agree with that. I think we need to inspire people to get that champagne bottle open on any sort of occasion. It doesn't matter.
I mean, I, as you know, report and talk about culture a lot. And one of the things that I've noticed about those that are very prolific in the current culture is they're not particularly joyful. They're not very happy. In fact, they're downright miserable most of the time. And they like to cloak all of us in this sort of veil of safetyism. When sometimes you just need to throw caution to the wind and just say no to that and actually embrace a little bit of joy, don't you?
Yes, yes, you do. I mean, you know me, I'm a dancer. I love dancing. So every possible opportunity, I'm there on the dance floor whirling around, usually with a very well-held glass of champagne, never dropping a drop, you know, spilling a drop. But no, I think people do need to just, as you say, embrace life. And we're all, in each in our own ways, having a difficult time one way or another. We know it's not easy out there. And it's not to say that you're going to drink champagne every minute of the day, but even I remember Comte Audouin de Dampierre, he used to import a champagne, and he always says, when we say everybody, well, hey, that's a little bit of a stretch, but generally speaking, everybody can afford a bottle of champagne at least once in their lives. When there's something fabulous that they want to do or they want to enjoy a moment or whether, as I say, it's happy or sad or whatever, they feel the need to have this champagne and it makes a difference to them. And I don't think it's, I mean, people will say, oh, I have some bubbles. Sorry, it's not the same. And I actually had this argument with a guy at a bar set in the middle of the vineyards in front of our property, so down the hill, it's a Russian-owned chateau, funny enough, and they've built a bar called La Ruin. Anyway, I met this guy in there, and everyone's dancing and partying and having fun and everything, and the staff had given us a bottle of champagne. Well, he decided to come over and start telling me all about how he was a Frenchman who was a, you know, champagne producer, or not a producer, he was a winemaker. He didn't own a company. He was sort of like a flying winemaker all around the world making champagne style, like method traditionnel. Well, he started going on and on and on about how, oh, it's just rubbish and this nonsense about champagne, and I'm making fabulous method traditionnel all around the world, and it's equally as good. as champagne. So we got into a bit of a tussle over it, to be honest. He just would not listen, and which, you know, I was getting a little bit pipped about it. The thing is, it isn't the same, and one of the main reasons, I don't care how good a winemaker you are, I know there is a difference between a method traditionnel and a good champagne. Now, I'm not talking about the run-of-the-mill champagnes, which are sort of second pressings or third pressings or whatever. You know, they don't go that extra mile. You know, they just do the bare minimum to be in the appellation for champagne. I'm talking about the ones that, you know, good champagne, like my Jacquard, or champagnes like Tanger and Runa and Paul Roger, and, you know, those really nice quality champagnes, Louis Roederer and so on. And to me, the moment if I drink something that isn't champagne, well, one of the first things I get is a headache the next day. So I'm very susceptible to the sulfites. And being made in Champagne, obviously, you know, with the terroir, having the particular terroir, which, as you well know, is all about not only where it is, but it's also about the soil and the whole terroir and so on, the structure and so on. It's all to do with the temperature, the slope of the Jolly Land, it's everything, you know, to do with it. And the fact that they have those freezing temperatures, you know, in a lot of the other areas, the vast majority of other areas, because they don't have the freezing temperatures, they have to put more sulfites in. And that's what's giving people the headaches. So, you know, it might taste great, and there's a number of method traditionnels that just for the flavour and everything, I've enjoyed them. Thought these are jolly good. But the next day I've woken up and thought, oh, God, you know, if I'd been drinking my champagne, for example, or an equally good one, I wouldn't have had that problem. So, you know, people will say, oh, no, well, everybody's drinking this or drinking that and so on, but it isn't the same. So I think it's really important to hold that protection for the champagne region.
Well, I think that protection, I think, goes for a great many things, doesn't it? You know, if the Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc industry were to have that in reverse, I mean, Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc is very, very distinctive. It doesn't taste like Sauvignon Blanc in France. It doesn't taste like Sauvignon in Italy. It is very, very, very distinctive. And in the same, too, I know the Italians are doing a lot of work around this appellation and food protection, particularly with their dairy products and meat products. And I think that's important because that is also part of preserving the uniqueness and the culture of those specific areas and regions. And food is one of the things that can do that. And I think that in our quest for being an international village, we've actually lost our own individualism in a nation. Mm. Yeah.
Yes, I agree with you. No, I think it's so important. And it makes us all so much more interesting too. Mm. Isn't it amazing when you go, you know how it is in France in particular. I always think of that since I know the area better. But, you know, you go to an area that's well known for its snails, or it's, you know, the breast chicken, or, you know, whatever it happens to be. It's just great because you just have such high expectations. And everywhere you go, you've got the wonderful, you know, you have different restaurants sort of doing their best for those sorts of things. I think we should do more of that in New Zealand, actually.
Mm.
Sure, I think it would be great.
Yeah, well, we've sort of done little bits here and there. I know with, you know, being in Hawke's Bay, and this is an area that you know well too, you know, we have that a little bit with our beef and a little bit with our own wine regions. But yeah, you're right. It just creates little micro industries in each place, and you see that around the world, and it should be cherished and bring back that joy.
Yes, yes, definitely. But I remember when I was on Housewives, what they asked, and I probably can't even remember what I said now because it was 8 years ago. I remember them asking me when we launched Bravo, they said, Anne, what is it you love about champagne? And I said, everything. And then I said, if you're going to have a good party, you've got to start with champagne. And this is the thing. Once you get the party going, the amusing thing is, you know, if somebody comes in, they have a red wine, or they have a beer, or they have a scotch or something, it's a bit sort of boring. But if you give them a glass of beautiful champagne, boom, everybody's spirits seem to be uplifted immediately. And usually what I find quite funny is they might say, oh, I'm not really a champagne drinker. They'll say that later. But, hey, after a couple of glasses, you can't get them off it. They want the next 10 dozen bottles of Gonsal. And, oh, no, no, I don't want a red. I'm happy with the champagne, thank you, because it definitely does. It just gives you such a rush of happiness and effervescence, and everybody starts chatting and laughing. And whereas you can give somebody a glass of red wine or a scotch or something, and next minute they're all maudlin and talking about something depressing, you know, politics, for example.
And the other thing too is you and I both like entertaining, and I do a lot of cooking. And one of the things that I always learned when I did wine and food matching back in the day. Now, if listeners, Leanne and I have known each other for a very long time, so hence the sort of references. And I actually think it might be more than 25 years since you've been importing champagne, because I know that I was bringing you back down to Gisborne even earlier than that.
Oh, yes, you were too.
I know.
You thought about, well, don't tell anybody that, Maria.
I know. You haven't, honestly, you haven't aged a dinner. But food, this is the thing with champagne. What people don't realise is that champagne is the ultimate palate cleanser. So yes. if you're gathering people for a meal, you've slaved all day in the kitchen, you've made something really special that you want to share with your friends, you want to make sure that they're ready to receive this food and it tastes fantastic. And champagne is the perfect thing to do that, because it sets the palate up, it sets your taste buds and gets you all tingling. So food tastes better.
It does.
They've actually studied that and proven it. So, you know, it's practical as well.
Beautiful. I must tell you about this, Marie, and I'm sure you'll be interested in this since you enjoy wine and so on, just as I do. I had to have some blood tests the other day, and I may have spoken to you just about it's actually my friend Michelle, who's the raw pharmacist. It's her detox liver tonic, which I swear by, so I actually buy it in bulk, and I'm sort of squirted down my throat about 5 times a day. It's the easiest way to take it rather than popping pills and, you know, the digestive issues and all of that, forgetting them and so on. Anyway, I went to have some blood tests unexpectedly at the beginning of the week. And anyway, I thought, oh God, if I was going to go and get my blood, normally I would have sort of gone a little bit easy on the champagne. just quieten down a little bit and make sure they come out okay. Well, I didn't have the opportunity to do that. And I thought, oh God. So I went to the doctor and he said, well, the results have come back. They're absolutely perfect. I said, oh, really? I sort of peered over his shoulder, was looking in there. I said, what about the liver? How's the liver? It's absolutely perfect, absolutely within range, only 18 and 35, and shouldn't be more than 60. And I'm thinking, yay, yippee. And I said, are you still drinking all that champagne? I said, absolutely. And so it was marvelous. And I thought, I said, well, I take this liver detox all the time, and it just shows you. And Richard was the same when he went for his. So it's amazing. But the thing is, I do feel, because predominantly I do just stick to champagne, apart from the odd cocktail or something, it is much easier on the body. Mm. Definitely, I mean, it is lower, and depending on which champagne you've got, but, you know, 12.5% is common, and sometimes up to 13. But, you know, how a lot of the wines now, I mean, they're 14% and up, if we only knew the truth, probably. And they're a lot heavier on the body, and the champagne is just so much easier. And being a real champagne, the sulfites are lower than a lot of the other wines, purely, you know, because of the fact there's that high acidity in the champagne. And also, you know, you've got those freezing temperatures and things like that, so you don't have the risk of all the oxidization and traveling with the grapes going off and all this sort of thing. So I think it's a wonderful thing to be drinking, and we need to boost the sales.
And just before we dive off champagne and move across to the pussies,
yes,
there has been some really high profile closures, both in Auckland and Wellington, of hospitality venues. I mean, does that concern you with that economic downturn, that it actually places where people go to meet and gather becoming more difficult?
Well,
to
it
access.
Does. And actually, Marie, I would like to speak a bit more about this, because that is extremely concerning. And one thing before I forget, I need to say, because I did mention to Ricardo, and I don't think it was in that article, is that now, sorry, before I jump into that, I have noticed, funnily enough, in the last couple of weeks, that there are a couple of champagne houses who are very clearly making an effort to lower their prices and push out a good deal to get the people into these restaurants. So now that is actually happening. Don't know whether it's anything to do with what we're all talking about, or whether they just worked that out for themselves. But what I find upsetting for myself is that I have done my absolute utmost to keep my champagne priced at the same price. And I sell direct to people, including GST at $65, which is a fantastic price for what is predominantly Grand Cru and Premier Cru first pressing, amazing champagne. So it's not a second pressing and minimum years of aging and all that sort of thing. So it's been really tough for me, but I've thought, no, we're in here for the long term. We've got to keep the champagne sales going. So, but what I've found is even though I haven't increased my prices in some of the restaurants, I won't say which ones they are, but they have put it up to a crazy price, like $190 a bottle. Now, who the hell is going to buy champagne at $190 a bottle at the moment? Quite frankly, and there's some at $220 for non-vintage bottles of champagne. And I think Ricardo said something about if the champagne lady won't drink it, who will? What mine boggles? Well, it's quite true because I used to go out all the time wanting to wave the flag, whether it was my champagne or another champagne, go out for a meal, bottle of champagne. Well, now, unless it's my Jacquard, I actually will only have a glass of champagne, if that, and I will have wine. And that's because, quite frankly, we can't afford to go out all the time and be paying that sort of money either. So I think what they should be doing, instead of whacking the prices up all the time just because they think, oh, we'll get some more margin, and they don't sell any under that theory, they would be better off saying, okay, let's make this a good deal. Let's get all those girls, and in particular, who'd love to have some champagne, let's put 100% on, sell it at $120 or $130, and let's say, come on in, glass of champagne for this price, et cetera, et cetera. Once you get the girls in, you'll often get the boys in, and they'll start drinking. Next minute, people think, well, this is great. Let's stay for dinner, whatever. And I think they're making a very big mistake. I've noticed that Moët are doing a special at the moment, and they're actually now, it's being sold at places at like $17 a glass. So they're obviously taking that theory along, which good on them for doing that. It's a pity that they're not doing something with mine like that. It would be better, but I'm just a small importer, so that's the way it works. But anyway, but the other thing we're talking about, because I've been visiting the winemakers and so on with my barrel run, and we're all talking about the fact that the wine industry generally is down dramatically. Mm-hmm. And I was reading in the Spectator magazine when I was flying over to France, and they said that there were 5,000 pubs had closed in the UK, and they put it down, a lot of it, obviously there's the drinking and driving issues, but they put a lot of it down to the social media issues, where you've got these young people, instead of going out to a pub to go and meet a girl or a guy or whatever, they go on to TikTok, not TikTok, Tinder, shows how much I've used it, onto Tinder, and they swipe right. Well, for goodness sake, I mean, that's totally changed the face of everything. And then I was talking to a couple of other winemakers, and they said, oh, yes, they said they think the idea of a good night is to have a shake and go to the gym, or they come home and have a couple of gummies. Well, that's just totally changed the face of life socially, hasn't it? So, you know, all of us who are older than them, I mean, not older, we're the only ones who are sort of trying to uphold the wine industry, really, aren't we? We need to somehow change it because it's absolutely devastating for it.
Well, it's that whole social cohesion. There has been this degradation in social cohesion. You know, you saw it with the lockdowns. You've seen it with the demonization of so many things. And I worry for our kids, and because I see so many of these millennials, and they're just miserable. They don't go out and have a lot of fun. And the ones that do are often maligned on social media. And, yeah, it's sad. I do – now, in saying that, though, I do have – some nieces that and nephews that do that, and good on them. And they also tend to be the ones that stay away from all of that, and they think, no, we are going to go out and live our lives. And
yes,
and that's what you want. And that whole sort of, again, coming together and meeting in person is just
so important. And the trouble is, but what I find, as far as it's devastating up at all, I mean, it's everywhere. I've just been to Blenheim, it's the same down there. It's very, very sad to see these amazing restaurants just disappear. And before, what we're doing, we're still going out as much as we used to, but we're definitely trying to go to more affordable places in the main and choosing somewhere where we think, okay, well, we can get out of here under, say, $130 or something, rather than thinking, oh, well, you know, it's going to be $300 for the night, but we're just not spending that sort of money now. And a lot of people will be thinking like that. But it's very, very upsetting to see these iconic restaurants just disappear. I mean, we came back to find SBQR gone. Oh, my God, this is one of our favourite places to go to. And to be fair, they were trying to bring the menu down a bit, make portions a little bit smaller, offer specials, and come in at this time and get a price for the drink or the meal, whatever. And it obviously still didn't work. It's very, very sad. And I think people need to really think about it and think, well, let's still keep going out, even if we change, you know, like us, just go a bit cheaper or whatever, but still keep supporting these places. Otherwise, they're just not going to be there at all.
No, no, I agree. It's it's amazing. You don't what is that song, the Amy Grant song? You don't always understand what you've lost until it's gone. So
that's right.
Yeah. Now let's get on to the pussies.
The pussies.
Let's get on to the pussies, because I was absolutely stunned about this. Now, of course, you're the founder of the New Zealand Cat Foundation. You've got the Pussy Palace out there at Goose Creek and QMU. Now, what is this game, Anne? Tell me about the game.
It's pretty amazing, actually. Because how it came about, I was discussing with a number of other people involved in cat rescue and so on, and it's a constant problem, the fact that councils and so on, and, you know, we've got the New Zealand predator-free ideas, and they want to get rid of every introduced species and all this sort of thing, which is very concerning, particularly when it starts involving our most loved companion animals, the pussies. And as you are well aware, I've been working with this for years and years and years and trying to do what I can. And unfortunately, government and councils don't seem to listen. And the only way, of course, to reduce the stray cat population, which is what they're concerned about, as it being affecting, you know, wildlife and so on, is through desexing. And the SPCA do their snip and chip programs from time to time and so on, but it's not enough. And there are a lot of rescuers out there, such as the New Zealand Cat Foundation, and a lot of just people, individuals, who are out there night after night trapping little stray cat colonies behind a factory, behind a restaurant, wherever it happens to be. It could be at a school, anywhere, behind an office block. These poor little souls who, through no fault of their own, have become stray because people are not taking responsibility for their cats. So this has been of a serious concern to me, particularly since we have horrific things like that cat killing shooting competition that I tried desperately to stop, and then that jolly Paddy Gower, he pushed it off again and off they went. And now you've got little children dragging poor dead cats, running around, shrieking, thinking they're amazing with their parents, treating them as if they're little saviors of the world. You know, it's just horrific what's going on out there, and I find that incredibly dangerous for our society that this sort of thing should be applauded and encouraged. Anyway, all of this sort of thing has, as I say, had me very, very concerned, and so I was discussing it with other like-minded people who are also concerned, and I was talking to Melanie Langlotz, who's the director and of the GOAR company, and they specialise in doing these. I'll get it right exactly what they specialise in, but they specialise in educational games, and often, of course, they're for governments and so on around the world. And we talked about this and decided that it would be a wonderful idea to do an educational game on cats. And the whole idea of it mainly is that it's really wanting to the game's exploring all sorts of topics such as desexing, microchipping, managing unexpected vet bills, understanding animal rights in a fun and educational gaming experience. Of course, it's aimed towards young people, although anybody can benefit from it if they feel so inclined. We did make it R13 because when you play the games, we've only got two of them up there at the moment. There's another four that are nearly finished, and we hope to end up with about 15 games, and they're going to be, you know, all different aspects of a cat welfare, looking after them, making sure that they're sexed, taking responsibility for it, et cetera, and reducing the stray cat population. And of course, one very important thing I want to stress, which is the councils are constantly trying to collapse, they're trying to collapse the categories legally under the Code of Welfare for Cats. There are three categories. There's domestic or companion, and you've got stray, and then you've got feral. Now, feral cats, they are the ones that are deep in the bush. They're well away from any human habitation, and they do have to rely on hunting for their sustenance. The stray cats are just an offshoot of the domestic cats, and they've come about because of, as I said, people not taking responsibility, getting them to sex, abandoning them, they've got lost, whatever's happened, and then, of course, they start breeding, and then they have to fend for themselves. So inevitably, if people don't assist them in some shape or form by throwing them tidbits behind McDonald's or feeding them behind a factory or just giving them food when they come to your back door, those cats would end up feral in the long term, or their offspring would, because of the need to survive, which anybody would. And again, they shouldn't actually be blamed for that. But what we're trying to do is reduce this. So what the game does, it's actually presenting players with various scenarios involving interaction with cats. So the players are given multiple choices for handling each situation, and these lead to either good or bad outcomes based on the decisions. So why we made it R13 is, of course, if they make a really bad decision, it could end up with a dead cat. Mm-hmm. Now, some children, of course, can't cope with things like that, and that they're just going to be completely traumatized. So we thought it would be better if it was a child who was a little bit of maturity and able to cope with that. So we've got all these different storylines, and the ones that we've got up at the moment is the search for Apollo, which we would actually like to expand a bit more now after we've got it up. We're thinking, yeah, we'd actually like to make that a little bit more in depth. So it's a cat that's disappeared off the property, sadly not microchipped, gone missing. So then you need to say, what do you do if your cat's gone missing? And so, of course, as I say, there's different options. You go and ask the neighbours if they've seen them. You put food out, you call, you search your garage, this type of thing. But now we want to actually make it a bit more in depth. For example, in the game, we said search the garage. Well, if you're a cat owner, you probably know how clever cats can be at hiding. So, and if they're injured or whatever, they'll go and hide somewhere. So you don't just glance through the garage. You've literally got to go and flip this, move that, get up on a shelf, you know, look behind something, even open up the bonnet of your car, where we've found a cat once on the motor, for goodness sake. We could have set the car going and killed the poor cat, you know. So it needs to be a little bit more in-depth and specific in that case. But, and then, of course, at the end of the day, the cat's not microchipped. And if they took the wrong decision, well, could have found that, oh, sorry, your cat was brought in to some rescue organisation. Our policy is to keep them only for a certain amount of time, not ours, but somebody else might say that, and your cat's dead. You didn't get it microchipped. So it's a learning experience. And then hopefully that child will go back again, go through the process again, and come out with the right answer, and they know what to do in these circumstances. So in other words, get your cat microchipped. And another one we've got is the pawns off my garden, where you have neighbours who take offence because your cat is popping over to their place and might be in the veggie garden or doing something and they don't want it there, or it might be spraying or whatever. So then you get these people who will go and say, oh, I'm going to get rid of that cat. I'm going to do something terrible. I'm going to shoot the cat. Well, you get some horrific things happening. And it's teaching those type of people that, hey, if you do that, there's going to be a knock on the door and the police are going to be there, and next minute you're in handcuffs, you're carted off. You know what I mean? You've got to teach these people how to go about things, handling a difficult situation. So what I'm hoping, and the rest of us are hoping, is that if we can get this out through, or put it, we're doing these big posters and so on, greeting cards, all sorts of ways, where we're, and social media, of course, but to get this situation out there, and your kid will go and click on the QR code and whoop, it's on their phone or whatever, and they will play these games. It will educate them. We want to get into things like scouts and girl guides and schools, vet clinics, everywhere, really push it. And the only way really to change a society is through education. And okay, it's not an instant fix, but it's the only way to do it, and it's the only humane way of handling the stray cat population.
Well, the importance too of responsible cat ownership and teaching our kids responsible cat ownership is through that they learn responsibility in life. They learn how to care for themselves. They learn how to care for their siblings, for people in general. The skills that you learn, they are something lifelong. And if you actually strip those away from children, as so many things are stripped away from our kids today, they don't learn those things. I mean, in our house, our oldest son is neurodivergent. He learnt care and empathy through our cats and dogs, because he could actually communicate and connect with them more readily than he could connect with people.
Of course, I understand that.
Yeah, so it's so important. It is incredibly important. Now, I've got here the games are currently active on catangelstriumph.com. That's catsangelstriumph.com. So we'll make sure we've got that in the show notes if anyone wants to check that out. And how many, what was it that you were saying? Was it 15 games that you are planning to
get? We're hoping to get 15 up, yes. And funnily enough, the game producers are actually GOAR. They are saying, well, if this is really successful, they might do one about dogs as well.
Brilliant. No, that's
because we need it for the dogs too, in a different way. They don't have the same sort of issues concerning the dogs, but they also need help and we need to sort things out there.
No, absolutely, because they're all part very much of our lives and we want to make sure that we keep them that way. Look, Anne, it's always such a joy to talk to you. And one of the things that I've learned from you over the years is that there are four wonderful ways to happiness, and they are champagne, cats, dancing and Dolly.
Dolly, yes, I love Dolly. Here's to Dolly.
Here's to Dolly, indeed.
You forgot the champagne, didn't you?
Oh, no, I started with the champagne.
Oh, you did? Oh, that's good.
Well,
yes, and champagne and posses, I love them both. Yes, Dolly and, yeah, and the guy, I just love it. It's great. What a life.
Well, Anne Batley-Burton, the champagne lady and the founder of the New Zealand Cat Foundation, thank you so much for your time here today on Reality Check Radio. It's been great to catch up.
Yes, you too. And I hope to see you up at the Pussy Palace for a glass of champagne soon.
Oh, definitely. It's a date. Take care.
Cheers.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.